Here's a dismissing adult who talks about his mother being loving. So he's just been asked to give a specific incident as far back as he can remember. And he says, "I don't remember." Well, because she was caring and supportive. And the interviewer says, "Well, this can be difficult because a lot of people haven't thought about these things for a long time. But take a minute and see if you can think of an incident or an example." "Well, I guess like, well, you know, she was really pretty and she took a lot of care with her appearance. Whenever she drove me to school, I was always proud of that when we pulled up at the playground." The interviewer, who still hasn't gotten an example of a loving mother, says, "Thank you. And I just wonder whether there might be another example." And the participant says, "No, I think that pretty much takes care of it." So here's someone who describes how his mother looks instead of describing her loving behaviors toward him. He also has trouble remembering, because most of these memories probably have been dismissed from his mind. So he's looking at superficial features as opposed to a truly loving mother. Now, what does a preoccupied adult look like? Okay. Participant says, "Yeah, sort of very loving at times, like people were in the old days, my youth. A lot of changes since then. I remember home, and home was good in that, and loving. That's just like my wife. Just like my wife is with my child. Taking him out to the movies tonight, da-da-da-da. Special thing he's been wanting to see all week. Actually, it's more like a month, that turtle movie. Don't like it too much myself. Saw it, though, now when it was in maybe 6 months ago. Yeah, she's very loving with him." And the interviewer says, "Okay, well, what things come to mind when you describe your childhood relationship with your mother as very loving at times?" Because obviously the participant here has gone off on talking about his wife and child instead of talking about his own experience. And the participant says, "Really great things, felt really special, really grateful to her for that. My childhood, I remember just sitting on the porch, rocking back and forth, watching my parents or maybe having some lemonade, this, that, and the other. Really special sorts of things, just me and her, grateful for all she did. I wasn't easy. My temperament was hard on her, kind of hard. Nobody like her. Me and my cousin from next town, going down soon. Really big birthday. She going to be 80. Gives my age away." So here's a person who sort of rambles on, uses examples that aren't relevant to loving, talks about his wife and child instead of him, his own experience, talks about sitting near her on the porch and drinking lemonade as an example of her being loving, and is sort of general in his description, grateful for all she did for me, that kind of thing. So that's an example of a person who would talk about his mother as loving, but show a preoccupied attachment style. Now, you might wonder about a negative description of an early relationship with the mother. So I'm going to give you three examples of interviews. These are from the Handbook of Attachment, which has a chapter on adult attachment. And these are segments of interviews that were done with adults. So here's an example of three different people who used the word troublesome to describe their relationship with their mother. First, I'll give you a secure adult. And the participant says, "Troublesome. Well, she was troublesome for me when I was young, no question. She yelled a lot of the time. I remember that. And she could spank really hard, and she got angry a lot. But like I said, my father left when I was 4, And she was trying to make enough of an income to support us and trying hard to keep us on the straight and narrow at the same time that she was away such long hours. I didn't like it what she did. Like one time she slapped me in the face over something my sister had done. But she never apologized. I hated the yelling when my report card wasn't up to par. Yes, troublesome, or maybe I should have said it was a troubled relationship. But while I wish it had been different, it wasn't. So here's a person describing very clearly and coherently what was troublesome about his relationship with his mother and what he didn't like. And so we see this as a secure, as part of a secure adult attachment interview. Even though he's reporting on negative behaviors, he's able to reflect on them, think about their impact on him as a child. At the end, he says, I wish it had been different, but it wasn't. So he accepts the reality of it, but obviously has reflected on it. So what about a dismissing person who would say his relationship was troublesome? All right, here's participant. Troublesome. Weak. Cried. Fell apart at funerals. And the interviewer says, I wonder if you have any specific memories of times you found her troublesome. Sobbed through her aunt's funeral. Embarrassing. Couldn't wait to get away. Next question. Here's someone who's not talking about mother being troublesome to him except embarrassing him. And is dismissing, clearly wanting to move on to the next question, not wanting to talk about this, and is quite dismissing of her of his mother. Weak, cried, fell apart at funerals. And obviously, a mother could still be very loving and be a kind of person who would fall apart at a funeral, but they haven't. This person hasn't reflected on his experience. He just sort of produces this as a canned response. And what about a preoccupied adult who uses the word troublesome to describe his relationship with his mother? Participant. Troublesome. That was an understatement. It was yell, yell, yell. Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? Well, Mom, it was because you were just at me all the time. Like last week, you started yelling at the only grandkid you've got when we had you over to dinner. And angry, she's angry at me. She's angry at her latest husband. That's the latest in a series. Now she's angry at her neighbor about a tree that's supposed to be blocking her view. And so on and so on. She's more troublesome. She stirs up little things like I was saying last week at dinner and this continues. So here's someone who has switched suddenly in the middle of this story about his mother in childhood to addressing her right now as if she were here in the room today. And this is one of the signs of incoherence in the narrative. He's also going on and on about the way he treated her grandkid, about their neighbors, about her latest husband, really not staying with the issue of early childhood. And this interview goes on from the part I mentioned, so it's clear this is sort of a rambling interview. And that's the way in which preoccupied adults tend to speak. In fairly rambling ways, their interviews tend to be longer, and they are they're not clear in their descriptions. So if you have an adult who's not an organized, attached adult, who is unresolved or disorganized, this unresolved category in adult attachment interviews invariably relates to an experience of trauma or loss. So speakers who are disorganized and unresolved, as they speak about loss or trauma, their coherence disappears. They have what we call lapses in monitoring of their discourse. They're not in touch with the fact that they're talking to someone and trying to make clear a statement, and that and what we found is that these parents, if a parent prior to the baby's birth is unresolved in relationship to trauma or loss, they are likely later to have a disorganized infant attachment relationship. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples, three examples, of ways in which unresolved trauma or loss can affect an adult attachment interview. So here's a mother who was talking about the loss, a loss in her childhood. The question is, did you experience any losses of people who were important to you in your childhood? So she was asked about it, and she said, yes, there was a little man, and she began to cry. It turns out this person was an elderly workman who had been employed briefly by her parents when she was 8 years old. Jokingly, he had asked her to marry him when she grew up, and she had said, no, you'd be dead. Not long after this interchange, the man had died unexpectedly of a brain hemorrhage. And this mother went on to tell the interviewer that it was she who had killed him. And the way she put it was, I killed him with one sentence. So here's a mother who, in the midst of an interview, sort of loses touch with rationality and goes back to the magical thinking of a child who believed that by saying, no, I'm not going to marry you because you'd be dead by the time I was grown up, believed that she had actually killed this man. And she has not resolved this loss because she has not come to an understanding that obviously her sentence was not what was killing this person. And that's the source of incoherence for that interview. You can also be classified as unresolved when you exhibit an abrupt and distinct change in what's called a discourse register. So this can be seen in a move where you pay extreme attention to detail that doesn't relate to the experience that you're talking about. So here's an interview where she says, we went to the hospital and I think it was the gray Buick, and I sat in the back to the right of my mother. I was wearing jeans and a polo shirt. Well, not jeans, but, you know, khakis. And we turned first down West Street, and then there was a lot of traffic, so we took another street. And this interview goes on. So here's a person who's talking about a trauma or a loss, and the information you're getting is about what clothes she wore and what street she drove down and what color the car was. It indicates a fear of actually dealing with what happened at this time, so that the person is just focused entirely on these details, which are not relevant. Another way a person may show incoherence in an adult attachment interview relating to trauma or loss is to shift very abruptly into eulogistic or funereal speech. So here's an example of a person who, in the midst of his adult attachment interview, starts talking about a loss. And he says, she was young, she was lovely, and she was torn from us by that most dreaded of diseases, tuberculosis. And then I remember time and time again the sounds of the weeping, the smells of the flowers, the mother torn from where she lay weeping upon her daughter's coffin. So here's someone who's not able to use typical interpersonal, direct, person-to-person language in describing the loss of what's probably a sibling. He shifts into this very artificial-sounding language and describes it as a way of distancing himself, it appears, from the actual experience. And these are all examples that come from an article by Eric Hesse, who has done a lot of the work on disorganization in recent years with Mary Main. So now I'm going to talk more about how we begin to translate what we know about attachment and to apply it in a therapeutic situation. And I think the first thing you need to think about is back to Alan Shore's statement that a sensitive caregiver downloads her right brain into the infant during the first 3 years of life. And that enables the infant to move from a chaotic lack of regulation of affect and regulation of attention, regulation of impulses, and regulation of bodily states to smoothly regulated ability to handle each new situation with tools that are learned from the parent. So in many ways, this is similar to what we do in therapy. We are in our dyadic relationship with the client, helping the client develop some of these skills. And we generally move from therapist-led regulation to co-regulation with the client to co-creation of new meanings for what the client's experiences are. Finally, to the development of competency by the client, emotional competency and regulatory competency, and the ability to fruitfully collaborate in solving the client's problems. I know some of you work with children and some of you work with adults, so I'm going to talk a little bit about both. But I'm going to start by focusing on the model of treatment that I've had the most training in, which is Dan Hughes' dyadic developmental psychotherapy. And I'm going to give you more detail about this, partly because I know more about it, partly because I think it helps to describe one model in detail in order to give you a sense of what the different aspects are of the way to work with a child who's had significant attachment disruption and perhaps trauma along the way. And if you think about it, for a baby, attachment disruption means trauma. When you think of the importance of the caregiver, essentially the caregiver is the child's world. So losing a caregiver means losing the world, the end of the world. And we can't say, oh, they were so young, oh, but the other caregiver was so nice, or anything like that, because for this child, that caregiver was the world. And it was traumatic to lose the caregiver, however it happened. So if a child has had experience of loss, and this doesn't necessarily mean death, it may mean the parent leaving, it may mean the parent is totally unavailable in relation to substance use or mental health issues. It may mean a number of things. That parent is not there for the child, and the child is experiencing a lack of safety and security and all the regulatory functions that the parent should be providing to the child. So I think we tend to underestimate the level of trauma children have experienced when they've had early losses. I know when I first started working in a new city before I had my license, I volunteered for a while on a pre-adolescent inpatient unit at a hospital. And one of the things I did was to read kids' charts. Usually, if a pre-adolescent was hospitalized, almost inevitably, there was an example in their chart in the history section of loss or disruption. Maybe the child went to live with grandparents for a year or two, maybe a parent disappeared, maybe kin took over at some point, maybe a parent was gone for a period of time when they were ill. And almost inevitably, these, to me, profoundly important experiences the child had early in life were not reflected upon in the rest of the child's chart, and they were not seen as the basis for a number of the child's problems. But I believe that they were, usually. So if you're trained by Dan Hughes, he's a delightful person, and I recommend his trainings. He says the goal of his model of treatment is to restore the joyful dialogic companionship, which was more likely to have been present during the early years, to discover the core reciprocal intentions that lie under the difficulties, to accept these intentions and to communicate with each other in ways that facilitate understanding, empathy, and interactive repair. So, let's talk about the features of this model of attachment-based treatment. It's dyadic. And the reason it's dyadic is that the child's problems occurred when the caregiver infant dyad was inadequate to support secure attachment. Healing also must take place in a dyad. And I think you understand by now why that would be, because it's in a dyadic relationship that we learn these important skills. The focus is on healing the dyad, the caregiver and the child. So even if you have a foster and adopted parent, so that the caregiver is not the one who didn't give the child what they needed when they were young, the relationship is troubled or they wouldn't be there seeing you. So you still need to focus on the caregiver as well as the child. And in order for the caregiver to provide a secure attachment for the child, they need a secure attachment themselves. And often this will mean that when you start working with a child, you'll find that the caregiver needs their own treatment to help them provide the security that will allow the child to become secure. So the focus of therapy is to help the parent become a therapeutic agent who learns effective techniques to heal the child's attachment. And so you're really asking a lot of these caregivers. And it's hard as a therapist to see a caregiver who can't provide the extra help that a child needs to develop this level of security. And it does take extra help. A baby is sort of programmed for their brain to soak up caregiving relationships and develop the skills they need to develop. If you are working with an older child or an adult who has developed maybe warped skills or maybe has never developed skills, they still have developed ways of being in the world. So essentially, you're needing to help them break those down and start with new ones at a time in their life when their brain isn't programmed to be soaking this up. So it's a particularly difficult project, and it takes a lot of time to do this. And that's one reason you're really training the parent as a therapeutic agent, because an hour a week, even 3 hours a week, isn't going to do it. The parent needs to be on the ground providing the security and the regulatory function on a daily basis all the time. So this therapy is also called developmental because the child's social and emotional development has been frozen or warped by poor caregiving. And the therapy must work with the child where she or he is developmentally, not chronologically. So it's very important to know early development to understand where the child is stuck. And I want to say one word about this working with the child developmentally and not chronologically. Some people criticize those who work in this field for infantilizing children or doing regression therapy and so forth. And I don't see it that way at all. I really think when you have a 10-year-old who's expressing needs in the way a 2-year-old might, you really need to deal with that 10-year-old in a 2-year-old way. And that's going to be sort of difficult because 10-year-olds don't like to be treated like 2-year-olds. So you're going to need to find a way to meet those 2-year-old needs without making this 10-year-old feel infantilized. Sometimes they don't mind being infantilized. I've worked with lots of kids who start to feel some of those early primitive feelings and crawl into their parents' laps almost immediately. But sometimes you have to be quite careful about how you go about providing them the love and the security and the skill building that they need. And you also find that kids developmentally may change the age that they are behaving. So they may be showing 2-year-old needs at one point, 4-year-old needs at another point. They may be looking perfectly normally developing at another point. Something happens, they regress, and they look more 2-year-old again. So it's sort of a moving target, and you have to keep meeting the child where they are developmentally. Dan Hughes has what he calls the attitude, which is the acronym for which is PACE. His treatment is always playful, and there's a need to help parents who are often sort of grim and frustrated when they bring a child in find an ability to playfully engage with their child. And Dan does this by example, and it's important for the therapist to provide that example so that a lightness can emerge in the relationship. Because you think about it, with babies, there's a really lovely lightness and joy that's occurring, playfulness, excitement. And children need that experience, even if they didn't get it early on. A is for accepting. And this is critical. Dan's very good at making it clear that he accepts this child. And even accepts whatever negative behavior may be the topic of conversation as the best way the child knows to achieve goals at present. This doesn't mean that he accepts that this is the way it's going to be, but that it makes sense to him why the child would have behaved this way. He makes sense of it, and then he helps the child find ways to move beyond that. The C in PACE stands for curious. Curious about why this is happening now. So Dan, when a child, you know, says, you know, last night at dinner I threw the plate at my mother, Dan will just sit there and be curious. I wonder why you did that. I would have thought you'd want to eat that food, but you really didn't want to eat the food, I guess, or what was going on? And so he, by that kind of sort of naive curiosity, he gives the child a chance to explain what the internal process was. And as you'll see, that's a really important part of what he talks about. The E in PACE stands for empathic. So he is infinitely empathic with this child, who may be pretty annoying at times. He's also empathic with the parent and what the parent's putting up with. So this attitude is a very important aspect of dyadic developmental psychotherapy. So parents in this model are seen as the agents of therapeutic change. And the problem is seen as being that the child hasn't learned to use a relationship to change and grow. And they have to learn this first with parents. It's Dan's belief and mine that you can't learn how to use an attachment relationship to grow. If you're doing individual therapy with a person who's not your attachment figure, it may be possible for adults and even for older teens to do this, to really see a therapist as an attachment figure and to use them that way. But younger children need more 24/7 contact and ongoing interaction for that. So most of Dan's therapy is done with the child and the parent present. Two of the primary processes that are taking place in this therapy model are the co-regulating of affect, starting with the parent or the therapist regulating the child, and the co-creation of new meanings. And if you think about it, it's really critical that when you have experienced negative experiences early, that you find a new way of assigning meaning to those experiences that enables you to use it positively and to grow from it. One of the things Dan Hughes talks about a lot is the use of intersubjectivity in treatment. Intersubjectivity is a concept that was, I think, originated by Colwyn Trevarthen, and there are two levels of it. The first level of intersubjectivity, which is important to use in therapy, is sharing a feeling between two people. So I'm happy, you see I'm happy, you share my happiness. The secondary intersubjectivity is seen as sharing attention to an object. So we're both looking at the dog over there running around, and we're sharing our attention and sharing our experience of watching the dog run around. Intersubjectivity is nonverbal at the core. The therapist is not neutral because they're really sharing in the experience of the client. And it creates a sense of safety that this client's experience is shared. And particularly when these are difficult experiences we're talking about, having them shared feels like someone's carrying your burden with you. From within the intersubjective stance, the therapist can co-regulate affect more effectively and help to co-create new meanings for the difficult experiences. This intersubjective experience also enables right-brain co-regulation. So it becomes, essentially, is what a good caregiver is doing with an infant, and it enables the therapist to do this with an older child or adult. Another important concept in Dan's work, it's also important in the attachment work we've talked about, is attunement. So the therapist is attuned to the child. At times, a child may be feeling very strong affect, and the therapist matches the vitality of that child's affect. So if a child's really, you know, yelling, "I hate you, you're the worst therapist in the world," whatever it's going on, the therapist needs to respond with the level of vitality that the child is experiencing. And so that you can say, "I see that you are really mad at me. I understand that that really is upsetting to you." What this means is you're sort of matching the level of the child's feeling. It enables you then to help bring down the feeling step by step and begin to regulate that affect into something more manageable that you can work with together. The result of this for the child is that he experiences himself being experienced differently, and it enables new meanings to emerge as a result of the therapist's reflective function on the child's process. Another concept Dan talks about a lot is affective/reflective dialogue. So the dialogue that occurs with the therapist is expressive both verbally and nonverbally, And it's integrated as both implicit and explicit awareness into the sense of self. So you are reflecting on the client's experience. You're reflecting on your experience of what's going on in the room. And you're enabling that reflection to become part of the client's understanding of how things are going. Often when these kids present in treatment, the parents are frustrated, parents are upset, the kid is angry, doesn't want to be there. And often, if they've been in treatment before, they've been given a lot of behavioral techniques to help manage the child's behavior. And often this hasn't been effective. Because a child who really wants to be in control because he doesn't trust adults for good reasons is a very strong child, and he can outwit almost any behavior plan you can come up with because his real primary goal in life is to stay in control. He's seen adults hurt him when they were in control too many times, and he's not going to let that happen again. So really, the job of the therapist is to help the child and the parent find a way to have a trusting relationship. And when a child is profoundly distrustful, this is very difficult. So the therapist's job in this model is to search under the presenting symptoms of the child, the parents, or the relationship, and to find new meanings for the symptoms. So a child who is behaving destructively, for instance, and who's been given consequences and consequences and consequences for this, it may be that you'll learn by talking to this child that he's feeling devalued. As a result, he tends to be destructive toward things. He's so angry at his own devaluation that he devalues other people and other things and acts destructively or aggressively. If you can get to this point where you understand how he's essentially expressing outwardly the feelings that are inside him, you can start with a real understanding of why one would feel like being destructive. And if you start there and you talk to him about that, you may find that it's possible to learn more about what is behind that sense that there's no point in trying. Alternatively, you may find a child, often children who are being placed in different homes through the foster care system, are convinced that they're going to be kicked out of this house too because they've lost all the parents they've ever had. And they believe strongly that they're going to lose this one too. And you may see them trying to provoke the rejection before, so that they're not once again surprised by the devastating loss of another parent. So they may be acting out almost intentionally to get kicked out of this home. They may be acting out against a sibling in the home because that sibling seems to have things or get things that they don't feel that they have or get, so they want to destroy that sibling's happiness. Whatever these things are, they go beyond the complexity of simply, oh, you broke this, therefore your consequence is you must earn the money to pay back or whatever it is, which doesn't get at what is lying under the symptoms. When you're doing the work in dyadic developmental therapy, you're always looking under the symptoms. And as I will explain in a minute, that doesn't mean you're not providing consequences, but you're trying to provide a context that will give new meanings or help the child find the meanings for their for the behaviors that they're doing. So you start with finding positive qualities about the child. And And central to the deepening of the intersubjective experience is the therapist's active curiosity about family members' experiences. So you're always curious. You're always trying to figure out what's beneath the symptoms. And children can be disarmed by this approach and can end up being more willing to talk. One of the central tenets of Dan's philosophy is that when children have experienced attachment loss and disruption, they live in a state of fairly toxic shame because they feel that they are to blame. I've never met a child who lost a parent who didn't feel that somehow they were to blame for that loss, no matter how unreasonable that might be. And that belief that I'm such a bad person that nobody would want to parent me is profound and pervasive in children's development. And Dan talks a lot about helping children turn shame to guilt, guilt being seen as a much more positive emotion. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the difference between shame and guilt. Shame has a focus on the self. It's about me. I'm bad. Whereas guilt has a focus on behavior. Oh, I did this thing that wasn't right. I broke my mother's favorite vase. If you feel that you're bad, there's no real remediation that's possible. Whereas if you're feeling guilty about breaking your mother's favorite vase, you may find ways to make it up to her. You may want to do nice things for her. You may want to buy her a new vase. You may want, there are a number of ways that you might find to remediate your behavior. Shame is concerned with other people's evaluation of you, whereas guilt is concerned with your effect on other people. Shame leads to a desire to hide or to attack others because the feeling is so profoundly negative. Whereas guilt leads to a desire to confess and repair the relationship. Shame leads to a sense of split self between the observed, devalued self and the observing self. And guilt leads to a sense of a unified self that's not devalued, that's made a mistake, but has done some things to make it better. So one can go on with a clear conscience and a good feeling about the self. Dan talks a lot in his treatments about breaks and repairs. If you remember in talking about attachment development, we talked about interactive repair and the importance of interactive repair in a toddler's evolving sense of self and the sense that I'm a good person even though I do things that are wrong. Often for these children who've lost parents and who've experienced trauma and abuse, there's an expectation that a break, they're doing something bad, means the end. And there's a sense of lack of safety. When that happens, the therapist needs to be noticing subtle signs of the break. And sometimes these can be breaks can occur when the child or client misinterprets what a therapist has said, or a therapist maybe comes on too strong or starts talking to a child about something negative that's gone on. And the child feels, oh, I've lost you. You're not on my side anymore. So it's very important in treatment to be noticing the subtle signs of the break, to comment on it, to accept it. There was a break. To use active curiosity to explore it, and to, in the end, repair. So you may be saying, you know, when a child suddenly folds his hands and turns away from you or stomps out of the room or says, oh, that's just the way you are all the time or whatever, happens that lets you know this child has just felt that there was a break in the empathic relationship, it's really important to be non-defensively curious. Wow, I didn't realize I was saying something that would upset you like that. Can you explain it to me? Can you tell me what happened and tell me how that feels to you? So by being curious, by being non-defensive, you can end up learning things. There may be an interpretation you would never have thought of what just happened or what the child was talking about. And that enables you then to move in and repair it. Oh, is that what you were thinking? You were thinking I didn't like you because I told you that it wasn't a good thing to break your mom's stuff all the time. You know what? I like you all the time, no matter what. I just want you to find a way not to be breaking things so that you and your mom can get along better and have a better life together. So you've essentially created a new meaning for what it is that you've just said that caused the break in the child's mind. Or if the child's gotten angry at you because you insist on talking about these negative things or whatever else it is, you also are given an opportunity then to say, I know this is so hard to talk about, but, you know, if we don't talk about it, we can never help you find a way to make it better. And I really want to help you find a way to make it better. You're given a chance to say these kinds of things, which can help bring the child along in the treatment session. So, as a foundation to do this kind of work, both parents and therapists need to be sensitively attuned to the child to help form a secure attachment. That means you put a lot less emphasis on talking about behavior and more on underlying emotions. I often talk to parents about Ross Green's basket system. He, in his book, The Explosive Child, talks about helping parents learn to put their concerns about a child into three baskets. The A basket are things like hurting other people or significantly damaging property. And those are things that really have to be addressed. The B basket may include things like unkind words, being, you know, bad manners, things like that that are important, but not as critical as hurting people and damaging things. The C basket may include all kinds of other stuff, like making your bed in the morning, cleaning up your room, making sure you bring home your homework, all kinds of concerns that parents have that are very legitimate concerns. But when we have A basket concerns that are really serious, we may need to let the C basket concerns go for a while. You keep them in the C basket, you plan to get to them, but you don't address them all at the same time. That can be overwhelming to a child and to a parent, and it can help parents a lot to do that kind of prioritizing of concerns so that you're not focusing on every negative behavior. You're providing comfort, containment, safety, and empathy because these are necessary to facilitate the child's ability to resolve their past traumas. And you believe that the child has to integrate their past experiences in forming a coherent understanding of self and relationships. So we talked a lot about the coherence of narrative in an adult attachment relationship, adult attachment interview. One of the things I didn't talk about is those adults who are what we call earned secure as adults. So these are adults who had negative experiences as a child and probably had an insecure attachment as a child. But as adults, as a result of therapy or a positive relationship with a partner, they have come to understand what happened to them, reflect on it, find new meanings, and develop a secure attachment relationship in the current setting and a secure attachment model, which has been earned, as they say. So that's what you're trying to help children do in the Dan Hughes approach. You're trying to help them integrate their past experiences and come up with a coherent story of themselves and their relationships. So I talked a little bit about using consequences, and obviously many of these children do all kinds of negative behavior. So thinking through how you use consequences is important. But one of the most important things is not to be punitive, which is very tough for parents to do often. Being punitive in a consequence tends to evoke shame in the child and anger. And when the child's shame is brought up, they can't constructively work on their behavior. So it's really critical not to be punitive toward these children. And sometimes that takes a lot of work with parents to help them not do that. You use consequences to ensure safety or to teach the child better skills. And when you deliver a consequence, you do it with empathy. Very tough to do. You say, you know, that your sister's doll that you just pulled the head off of was her favorite doll, and she's going to be so sad that that's broken. I think I'm going to need to help you find a way to pay her back so she can buy a new doll. And that's going to mean doing a lot of chores for the next period of time in order for you to earn back some money so that you can pay her for the doll that you broke. And I know you're not going to have fun doing that, but I'm going to help you do them, and we'll get them done, and you'll be able to help your sister find a new doll. So that's such a different way of delivering a consequence from the, you know, oh, that means, you know, you owe me $10 and you better start earning it right now. It's the empathy gives the child confidence that you're still on his side, even though he did a bad thing. You're going to help him figure out how to make it better. And, but he's going to have to do it. I mean, you don't let a kid like this off when they do something when they seriously misbehave. The other thing I often teach parents in a situation like this, because they tend to get angry so frequently, is to do what's called a 60-second scolding. A 60-second scolding is to start with anger. You know, I am so mad at you because you just tore the head off your sister's doll, and you know she loved that doll so much. And I know that that's a very important doll to her, too. And I know that must also make you feel pretty bad inside that you did something like that to your sister. And I know that I don't like to see you feeling so bad. And, you know, the reason I don't like to see you feeling so bad is because I love you so much. And I really want to help you find a way to have a better life without doing mean things like that. So you move from anger and maybe a loud voice and talking about what the provocation is to why it matters to you and to the child, to why the child matters to you, and to a message of love. That's a big shift in the course of 60 seconds, but if you can learn to do it, it gives a parent a chance to express their anger, which they have, but also to end up with empathy and love. So Dan talks about stages of trauma resolution. So a child's been traumatized either just by the loss of a parent, and I shouldn't say just, but that may be the only trauma the child's had, or by more complex traumatic situation. It's important to realize that the adults serve as the source of attachment security. As safety emerges in the relationship, you can start to talk about mildly stressful themes for intersubjective exploration. Once primary intersubjectivity is established, the sharing of feelings, you move to secondary intersubjectivity, which is talking about the trauma together, sharing feelings as you talk about something different. Secondary intersubjectivity allows the child to re-experience the trauma as experienced by the therapist, who is also co-regulating the affect in the time that you're talking about it. And since that affect is no longer dysregulating, it's possible to create a new meaning together. And that new meaning can then be integrated into a coherent autobiographical narrative. I realize this, I'm covering a very large amount of material in a short period of time. And I would encourage you to do some training with Dan Hughes if this intrigues you, because learning how to make use of these concepts is a very rich way to do therapy with children who've been traumatized. So I'm just going to read you some basic assumptions from Dan's website that are important for parents to recognize and important for therapists too. Your child is doing the best she can. This is very basic. And it's not what most parents think when they bring a child in for therapy. And finding a way to make sense of that statement is often a big project of therapy with the parent. That your child is actually doing the best she can? What does that mean? How can you make sense of that? So he wants to improve. Her life, as it is now, is a living hell. So he tries to be safe by controlling everything in his environment. She tries to be safe by avoiding everything that is stressful and painful. His attacks on you and his resistance to you reflect his fear of your motives. Poor affect regulation, fragmented thinking, pervasive shame, inability to trust, and lack of control. For her to change, you will need to accept, comfort, and teach her. And this means accepting the child, not always the behavior. You will need to validate his sense of self while teaching him important skills. You will need to know her developmental age and fine-tune your expectations to match that age so that she will have success, not failure. Your physical and psychological presence are the foundation of your comforting and teaching her. Under stressful emotional conditions, he will regress and revert to his basic solitary defenses he learned in his first home. She will have to work hard to learn how to live well. You cannot do the work for her, nor can you save her. You can comfort and teach her. You will need support and consultation. You will make mistakes, and you need to face these, learn from them, and continue. On his website, there's also a list of what is not done. And some of these practices are things that have been done in the name of attachment therapy in the past. And it's important to stay away from them because they're very damaging to children. So these things are not done. Holding a child and confronting them with anger, or poking or pushing the child while holding them. Covering a child's nose or mouth or lying on top of the child. Utilizing shame, sarcasm, or laughing in a child's treatment. Laughing at the child, that is. Any actions based on power and submission, you know, where the adult asserts their power and the child is submissive, done repeatedly until the child complies. Interpreting the child's behaviors as meaning that she or he does not want to be part of the family and giving consequences for that. So in order to do this kind of treatment, it's tough to do. You must have resolved your own attachment trauma or insecurity, because you can't provide a secure base unless you have a really solid attachment model yourself. And it's pretty uncanny how kids with attachment issues can find the issues that you have and hang them out to dry on the line and make your life evoke shame in you if that shame is available. So you need to have resolved an awful lot of this, and you need to help parents do it too. The therapist must be comfortable with both adults and children, because you're really working with both. Therapist must be comfortable not always being liked. And the therapist must have a good sense of humor, because if you can't laugh, you're going to be in trouble. So that's Dan Hughes' model of attachment-focused therapy. I'm going to just briefly review a few other models. Dan's model has not been researched extensively. There have been a couple of small studies on it that have shown some success. But other models do have some empirical basis and are actually now being used in trainings because of that empirical basis. One of the approaches is called Attachment Regulation and Competency by Margaret Blaustein and Christine Kinneberg. They have a book on that you will find in the bibliography describing this technique. And although it's a kind of a phase-based treatment where attachment regulation and competency are taught separately, there's an understanding that in treatment, the clinician will need to interweave the three aspects of treatment as treatment goes along. So attachment in this model is addressed primarily through training caregivers, including caregiver affect management, especially when the caregiver's own attachment history has been challenging. So helping the caregiver manage affect in order to help the child manage affect is critical. So helping the caregiver find a way to be attuned to the child is important, especially when the child behavior is challenging. Helping the caregiver provide consistent responses to the child behavior establishes felt security and reduces the child's perceived need for control. And helping the caregiver provide routines and rituals for the child establish a felt security also and build trust and reliability. So attachment is largely done by working with caregivers in this model. Regulation includes identifying affects. So often children who've had insecure attachment history or disorganized or traumatic background have not learned to even know what it is they're feeling. And if you think about it, the way you learn that is in the attachment relationship. And once again, they haven't had someone there saying, "Oh, you look sad right now," or, "My goodness, you seem worried about walking up those stairs," or all kinds of ways in which we are constantly labeling for little children what we're perceiving their feeling is. So children who haven't had that happen often don't know what it is that they're experiencing. So they need to find a way to label that internal experience. And that's the first step of regulation. Secondly, we are looking at affect modulation. So we're especially learning to express affect within optimal levels of arousal. So a well-balanced person in life usually manages affect in a way that's a fairly smooth wave. So you may become upset, then you usually find a way to calm yourself down. You may become very excited and happy, and gradually that excitement and happiness fades a new feeling takes over. Whereas a child who's been traumatized tends to be sort of way above the line of normal affect expression or totally shut down. They don't have the middle range available to them. So helping them learn that is a tough job, and it's an important job for parents and therapists. And then helping them find safe ways to express their affect, especially when their early experiences have led to the sense that affect expression can lead to vulnerability and lack of safety. So the purpose is to express affect that promotes relationships and helps them meet their needs. But you can imagine a kid who's been beaten for crying when they were hungry is going to be afraid to cry. So helping them learn to do that in a safe environment is important. The third skill in this model is competency. So, you know, a child who's had early trauma or negative attachment experiences has not had a chance to build competency in all sorts of areas of life. And the first step of building competency is building those right brain skills, those executive function skills we talked about, like learning to plan, anticipating consequences, inhibiting impulses, focusing attention. So those skills are necessary in order to build competency. And those are hard to teach. They take a long time. Competency also includes assisting a development of the self and identity so that you have a sense of a cohesive and positive self. And competency training also includes identifying and building key developmental tasks that are getting in the way of the child being able to do what he wants to do. The book that Blaustein and Kinneberg wrote, Treating Traumatic Stress in Children and Adolescents, has much more detailed descriptions of each of these phases of treatments, as well as very valuable, copyable handouts that are useful to help teach children and caregivers new skills. They really give you hands-on tools to use as you try to teach these skills, because explaining a skill to a child is completely inadequate as a way of teaching them how to make use of it. So I think you'll find this book very valuable if you're working with children who've had these experiences. There's several authors who have developed ways of working with traumatized children using EMDR. The names I mention here are Joan Lovett, Deborah Wesselman, and Lasher, Nichols, and May. There's also newer work by Ana Gomez and others. These models tend to include focusing on regulation by using what's called resource installation or resource development within EMDR. So you can build positive traits and skills, help the child imagine having better skills, and help them develop those skills by using resource installation tools in EMDR. And then usually the biggest focus in these models is trauma, developing a trauma narrative that can be created by the child or the therapist with the parent. A trauma narrative, your goal is to help the child move from an overwhelming and affectively negatively charged model to one that has a new meaning for their history and gives them a way to move beyond it. EMDR seems to be a good model to use for working on serious trauma because it often allows the child to process frightening material with less abreaction and distress. Another model of treatment for children who've had negative attachment experiences and trauma and loss is infant parent or child parent psychotherapy by Alicia Lieberman and Patricia Van Horn. They've also written a book on this topic, and it's a useful book for therapists who are working especially with young children. Their model is primarily psychodynamic, long-term treatment for young children and parents who are at risk or who have hurt their child or who have children who've been hurt in the past. It's been informed largely by data on intergenerational transmission of attachment and trauma that we reviewed earlier. And the focus is on the caregiver to provide her the mothering and a chance to resolve her own trauma so that she can become the adequate caregiver for the child. Lieberman was influenced largely by Selma Freiberg, whose studies in infant mental health are wonderful studies to read if you haven't read them yet, about the experience of providing child-parent psychotherapy. And really, Selma Freiberg began this field of infant-parent psychotherapy. The focus within this model is on empathic communication skills, such as those found in secure attachment. The final intervention I want to talk about that's attachment-focused is called ABC. The ABC intervention by Mary Dozier in Delaware. This is a short-term in-home intervention. It's 10 sessions long for at-risk parents and babies or toddlers. It's also been used with foster parents and toddlers and babies. And its aim is to enhance sensitive, nurturing care and to decrease frightened or frightening behavior by mothers towards babies, because we know that being either frightened or frightening toward your baby is more likely to cause disorganized attachment on the part of the baby. So the impact of this change in maternal care is to enhance the child's attachment organization. So what their mothers are taught in this 10-session intervention is to provide nurturance even when the child seems to be rejecting it, to take delight in following the child's lead in play, and to stop intrusive, frightened, or frightening behaviors toward the child. And it's also to recognize how parents' own attachment histories may interfere with their doing these behaviors, and then consolidate the gains in the child and the parent. What's remarkable about this intervention is that in 10 sessions, it's with sort of a coaching intervention, there have been dramatic results in improving mothers' sensitivity and responsiveness and in changing children's and mothers' attachment patterns. So this is a very promising intervention for young children and parents, and one that may help prevent a lot of the longer-term consequences of attachment-based trauma in young children. The final model I'm going to talk about is sort of an integrative model of using attachment theory in therapy with adults. A number of authors have talked about using knowledge from attachment in their work with adults. And I think probably the most useful book I know of for working with adults is by David Wallen on the use of attachment in therapy. And it's in your bibliography. So my first slide shows this quote from Bromberg that sort of evokes Dan Siegel's concept of interpersonal neurobiology. The therapist's right hemisphere allows her to know the patient from the inside out. So this is talking about a very profound dyadic communication along the lines of this interpersonal neurobiology. in which the therapist is able to grasp what the patient's inside understanding of life and themselves can be. So what do you do as a therapist who's really trying to make use of attachment theory? One important piece of it is to use the therapist as a secure base. That's one way we talk about parents, as a secure base for their child. So I did talk about the fact that I really feel that in treating children, you need to help parents be the secure base, the attachment figure for their child. When you're working with adults, obviously there's not a parent there who can provide that. So you really need to find a way to provide this secure base for your client. And because a client is old enough to use the skills of internalizing your security as part of their ongoing feelings in their life, they can carry you with them. You can actually become a secure base for a client, for an adult client. And in session, you use your regulatory ability to co-regulate with the client. You may need to actually do the regulation for them for a while, move to co-regulation as you do with a child, and then help them internalize that regulation as their own. It's important in treatment where you're thinking about attachment to be aware of what is evoked in you by this client and how you can make use of it. So countertransference is a critical aspect of doing this type of therapy. When you're attuned to a client, even when you're not attuned often, you receive projections from the client of emotional material that's defensively excluded from their consciousness. And you can use this information, this material, where feelings are evoked in you that don't belong to you. And you can use it as information that shapes your treatment plan, or at times it can be carefully presented as material to the client that can now be integrated. And in this process, you're helping the client co-create new meanings and integrate into themselves previously excluded aspects of affect or information. You're also helping them by presenting a positive view of material that they has felt so negative to them that they couldn't let it be part of themselves. If you can, just as you would with a child, say, well, all right, I guess I can understand how that would make you feel so rotten. But on the other hand, you know, I see it as a perfectly reasonable way to react to this situation you were in. By helping them do this, by helping them find new ways of understanding what their own feelings and behaviors are, they can then begin to integrate them and develop a more coherent sense of themselves. They don't have to leave anything out. So, just to talk a little bit more about projective identification, we have to be really careful with clients who have severe attachment histories, because it's really easy to end up acting out what the client in many ways expects of us. So a client who's rigidly excluding aspects of themselves will often project those onto the therapist, who may unwittingly play out the behavior evoked in him or her by the client. So a client may evoke in you a desire to rescue, to reject, or misunderstand them. And if you're not if you're not recognizing that this is coming from the client and you act on it, you've reinforced their internal working model that they're going to be rejected or they're going to be misunderstood or whatever. And that's going to make their life harder, and it's going to stop the progress of therapy. So attention to countertransference and the ability to process what's going on in that way is required to work through these situations and to provide limits with empathy as opposed to rejection. So if you think of someone who always comes late, who blames you for planned breaks, who feels misunderstood at times, it's easy to be annoyed at a client like that. It's easy to end up acting in rejecting or misunderstanding ways. And it's really important to be exploring this within yourself first to understand, is this the client's projective identification? Is this some remnant of my own history that's coming up to cause me trouble? And then it's important to figure out a way to use it in the therapy, whether or not you discuss it with the client, to find a way to avoid enacting what it is that the client's projecting onto you. It's important in work with adults, just as it is with children, to be aware of shame versus guilt. When there's been an insecure attachment history, the client tends to see themselves as broken or bad, which is the result of a pervasive shame in their history. And as we talked about earlier, shame is not reparable. If the self is bad, you either have to cover it up or put on a false self or project out that negative picture onto someone else. Guilt, on the other hand, is reparable. It's possible to acknowledge bad behavior and make recompense. So in treatment, by the therapist's insistence that what the client did is not reflective of his badness as a person, but only an understandable response to a situation he found himself in, the client's gradually able to transform shame into guilt and eventually come to the point of developing empathy for himself. This is a very long process when somebody's got shame that's really pervasive as a basis of their identity. But it's an important one to work on. And I think every time you realize there's shame being experienced, it's important to address it, because that move from shame to guilt is a critical move in developing a stronger sense of self. So just as with children, it's important to recognize empathic breaks and repair them. So there will be times when you misunderstand what a person's saying. There may be times when you come late to an appointment. There may be times when you don't answer the phone when the client calls. There will be times when there's a break between you, either that's your fault or not your fault, but it's important to recognize that it's experienced as a break, as a loss, and to provide repair. So sometimes you may just misperceive what a person says. Sometimes you may have done something that is harmful. In any case, these are very rich experiences in therapy. And just as with a toddler who needs thousands of times to be told no, and then to be provided love and understanding and have an explanation of why the no occurs, so in therapy, it's rich material when you can say, oh my gosh, is that what you thought I meant? I can see why you were so upset with me. And then you can go on to repair it. Or, you know, some clients will perceive you being away for a planned break as an empathic break. They may see that as a rejection or abandonment. And helping them understand that you can you can understand from their history why this would feel like an abandonment. But you also need them to know that you still care about them and you really want to be with them is important. So every time there's a perceived break of any sort, I think it's critical that you really mine it for all you can, because it is one of the most important ways we have to help people shift their understanding of how people work in reaction to them, because they have such a negative view from the first model they formed. It also increases the client's ability to have reflective function. When you keep showing it, oh, I said this, and you thought I meant that. Oh my goodness, that must have been so disturbing. I really will try not to say it that way again, but I want you to know what I was talking about was really this. That's all using your own reflective function to reflect on the process between you and the client, and encourages them to start doing the same thing. So when you see reflective function in a client, it's always a wonderful time in therapy, and it's important to point it out because it means the client's moved into the ability to start to process material on their own. And it's important. So it's important to notice it, and it's important to help clients nurture the ability to do that kind of reflection, and to extend it into therapeutic and non-therapeutic interactions. I think it's also important to think about coherence, just as we did when we were talking about the adult attachment interview. When Mary Main was first developing the adult attachment interview, she came upon this notion of coherence, which had been described by a linguist named Grice. And he has Grice's maxims of coherence. The four aspects of language that you need to look at are quality, whether the person is truthful and has evidence for what they say. That's considered coherence of quality. Quantity, whether the person is succinct yet complete. And I think if you remember a couple of those interviews that I read you sections of, a dismissing client is often too succinct. They just give you a sentence or two. And remember the one person who said, next question, after they'd given a very brief description. So they weren't complete. They were succinct, but not complete. Or the preoccupied person who was going on and on about his mother and his wife and other people, and that person was not complete because he wasn't really addressing the question, but he also was not succinct. There's also coherence in relationship to relevance, so that the question is answered by a relevant answer. And I think you remember from those interviews that a couple of the people gave answers that didn't relate. They didn't tell you what was troublesome about their relationship with their mother when they were young. They went off on other tangents, like what their wife was like with their kid. So relevance is a critical part of coherence. And manner is the fourth aspect, the fourth maxim, that you should be clear, brief, and orderly. So you should really come across with a good response that makes clear what the answer is and gives the person a good, clear understanding of what that answer was about. So if one of the most valuable trainings I did was training in rating the adult attachment interview, because it caused me to start paying a lot more attention to the language my clients were using. When they began to violate one of these maxims of coherence, or particularly when they started having lapses in their discourse so that they were showing evidence of disorganization or unresolved trauma or loss, I was much more able to pick it up just by the way they talked. And if you can do that, it helps you find the places where the person is beginning to feel like they need to exclude information from the therapeutic session or even from their own consciousness. So when you're paying attention to the narrative of a client, you need to look at whether they are flexible and complete versus rigid and incomplete in their description of things. Flexibility and completeness are really hallmarks of coherence. And rigidity almost always is a reflection of incoherence. You should also notice breaks in narratives. When a person pauses, that may be an indication they can't talk about what has just come into their head. You need to look for changes in tense, person, or tone, because those may indicate places where someone's just gotten derailed from a coherent explanation of what's going on by something that's defensively excluded. And you need to notice the adequacy of the description and what's left out. Is it emotional information or cognitive information? When information is omitted, or when there are evoked reactions in the therapist, those things can point to a type of insecurity that the person is feeling. And that can help you know how to address what's going on with them. If you read David Wallen's book, he has extensive descriptions of ways to work with avoidant or dismissing clients, ways to work with preoccupied clients, and so forth. The other thing you need to notice in narrative are experiences of dissociation and lapses in what's called metacognitive monitoring. So dissociation, obviously, is often associated with unresolved trauma or loss. Similarly, a lapse in metacognitive monitoring is associated with those things. What metacognitive monitoring is the ability to monitor your own discourse for coherence and relevance. Most of us, as we talk, we're thinking about what we're saying. We're thinking about whether what we've said makes clear to the other person what we're trying to communicate. And that means we have an understanding of the other mind with whom we're communicating. And we'll talk differently with a child than we will with an adult, for instance. And we'll talk differently with some adults than with other adults because we have an understanding of the differences in their minds. When you see lapses in metacognitive monitoring, when people sort of lose the context or begin to talk in ways that don't make sense in the overall narrative, you're more likely to be looking at an unresolved attachment pattern. And being able to do that really gives you clues to where these patterns may have originated, because you'll find that they come up when the person's talking about an early experience or even a later experience that may evoke an earlier experience in their lives. You need to pay attention in treatment of adults to their arousal level. So part of providing regulation is to keep the client in what we call the therapeutic window. And this is true whether you're working with adults or children. The therapeutic window is the space in which arousal is high enough to keep the client engaged, so they're not shut down, but it's not so high that cognitive processing is lost. So if a person is very aroused, either by fear or anger or even excitement, their cognitive brain, their left brain, is not functioning as well. And when a person is like this, they're not learning from you. So what you need for the therapeutic window is to have this optimal level of arousal that may go up and down some, but it doesn't go beyond the window where the person is not available to learning. It's important with adults to help them learn to notice their arousal level and to develop skills to calm themselves through distraction, breathing, relaxation exercises, or meditation. And the process of trauma really needs to proceed slowly, staying within the therapeutic window. It's critical that you start noticing when a person moves into re-experiencing as opposed to retelling. So if they're re-experiencing a trauma, they're no longer able to process it. They're living there. So you need to help them stay within the therapeutic window, even if that means you do tiny amounts of processing at a time, because you're essentially losing them as soon as they move out of that therapeutic window. So I talked a little bit about earned security as adults in adult attachment. What we find in earned secure adults is that they can tell their story truthfully with a full understanding of the impact of early experiences and an ability to look at the experience from the point of view of their caregivers as well as their own point of view at the time. They may be sad or angry, but they don't get lost in sadness and anger. And they're able to describe what they've learned from that attachment experiences and how those how their learning from those experiences has informed their changes in identity and their plans for the future. They're also able to talk about how they parent their children or wish to parent children as a result of those changes. So essentially, a lot of therapy with adults is rewriting their attachment narrative to help them find a new ending for the story, to help them find a way to make sense of what happened, to use what they've learned, to build new building blocks of the self, and to develop confidence and an ability to move forward in a life that they choose. Achieving earned security is a long process and requires using the therapist as a secure base. Sometimes people can do this within an intimate relationship, a marriage, or some other relationship. And it requires coming to understand transference responses and moving toward empathy for the self as well as for one's early caregivers. Typically, when you hear an adult who's earned secure talk about their early caregiving experiences, which were not positive, you'll hear them say, well, you know, at the time, the way it felt to me was she just didn't care about me. But now, when I look back on it, I can see how complicated her life was then and how she had to focus on other things in order to continue, and I just couldn't be a priority of hers at the time. So this person is reflecting, using reflective function to think back on the experience, think back on what their experience was, but use their adult mind to understand also the mind of their caregiver and make an interpretation of the caregiver that may be different from the one they made at the time they were as a child. So in a way that one tends to develop empathy for that caregiver as well as for the child in that situation. That achievement of earned security is inherently a dyadic process that can only be achieved in relationship. And finally, whatever model of attachment-focused treatment you use, this is very intense work, and you need to think about self-care even more than you do when you're not doing attachment-based therapy, when you still need to think about self-care. So therapists are only good at providing regulation, attunement, and a secure base if they themselves have achieved a flexible and fairly complete understanding of their own attachment history. This usually means doing some significant treatment yourself. An ongoing work of this nature is intense. It requires access to consultation, time away from one's practice, spent in rest, renewal, and recharging in one's own attachment environment. All of this enables you to work with the transference and counter-transference processes that are occurring in a way that makes sense for you and for your clients. So I hope this has been a helpful introduction to attachment. I don't think you're prepared to go out and do attachment-focused treatment now, but maybe you've been intrigued enough to explore it some more and to take on learning one of these models so that you can, in the future, be a much more effective therapist. Thank you for your time.